I asked God to have people who had problems paying their bills to watch me
and
today.
Call me
and make your vow of faith.
Make a vow of faith of $1,000
right now for $10,000.
And you need to make a vow of faith of $1,000. Oh, Bob, couldn't you say 25? No!
The pulpit does not protect the preacher from any of the seven deadly sins. Oh no. And evil men and women will shield their sins with the word of God, if you give them an audience.
The legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls who don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir.
You don't know anything about the Bible.
These guys are losers, bad liars, and thieves behind the scenes, but on their church's stage, they are cloaked with the confidence to turn a trick on any victim. They use bullshit prophecies to pickpocket the poor, steal innocence from the naive, justify abuse, and even murder.
Now deciding if the former preacher is guilty of killing his wife.
Guilty of the offense of murder.
Guilty of first-degree murder.
They claim that God told them to murder their sister-in-law, Brenda, and her baby.
Spreads out like a spider web through Washington, D.C., right up to the steps of the nation's capital, the steps of the White House, involves some of the most respected and powerful and richest businessmen in this United States of America. And the centerpiece of the entire web is the use of children for sex and drug dealing.
I'm your host, Rachel O'Brien, and this is Seven Deadly Sinners, a podcast that exposes false prophets and cult leaders as the phony criminals they are.
Sex scandal will not kill the televangelism industry. Swaggered and a prostitute to church leaders.
And we even throw in a few unknown serial killers for good measure.
Back off, devil!
Forget your church. I'm talking about what God said.
We are boots on the ground, knocking at the doors of actual cult compounds, interviewing victims, and likely hinging on the edge of safety to do so. So now, let's close our eyes, bow our heads, and buckle up.
I have sinned against you, my Lord.
My hands to pray, and he did. Then afterwards, he started to kiss me. Then he just took my hand and led me to the bedroom.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening and for sharing your stories with us. We are always looking for more listener stories to share on future episodes, so if you have a story that is anything strange, spooky, culty, the unexplained, maybe you have a crazy family story, or an ex you found out was a serious bullet you dodged, or a survival story, really anything, we want to hear from you. So send your stories into 7deadlysinnerspodcast@gmail.com. Okay, now for the case. We are traveling back to where the religion that spurred one of the deadly massacres in Western history in the 1800s began. Sources for this episode are Mountain Meadows Massacre by Juanita Brooks, a Smithsonian article, a PBS article, Wikipedia, and an in-person visit I had at a stopover on our road trip at the historic Fort Bridger, where I learned more about this massacre and was inspired to cover it. To understand this dark place in history, you have to know a bit about how the religion began. We've spoken a tad bit about Mormon history, but to give you a short rundown of its infancy, here we go. Mormon founder Joseph Smith was born in Sharon, Vermont on December 23, 1805. By 1817, he had moved with his family to Western New York, the site of an intense revivalist movement where preachers, prophets, swindlers, and confidence men, also known as con men, peddled their visions and ideas to a society primed to soak it up. Life in the early 1800s wasn't easy, so this second Great Awakening, as it has been called, gave the people something, or well, many different things to choose to believe in, as this area of the country was filled with new religions cropping up, and has even been nicknamed the, quote, burned over district, which implied the area was set ablaze with spiritual fervor. Joseph Smith, however, even at the tender age of 14, did not buy into any other man's religion. Oh no. It was at 14 that he had his first vision. In it, he was told that the true Church of Christ was no longer upon the earth, and was promised that if he proved worthy, the time would come when he, himself, would help establish it. Soon in 1830, a group of six young men organized the church, which was later to become known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Later, the members of the church became known as Mormons, and the church itself as the Mormon Church, because of a book published by Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon, which was inspired by his alleged encounter with an angel who directed him to a buried book of golden plates inscribed with an ancient language that described the history of an ancient American civilization. Smith's followers quickly grew, and they moved out west to Ohio and then Missouri. But tensions grew with non-Mormon settlers, and basic disagreements, or community growing pains, turned into mini battles. To be fair, the Mormons were severely persecuted, and more than a few Mormons were tarred and feathered. That is a practice that I don't even know where you'd come up with that. Just like, all right, you got some tar, you're working on the oil fields, wherever tar comes from. Hey, you got a chicken? Pluck that chicken. You bring the tar, you bring the chicken feathers. We're going to humiliate this guy. This is really going to get him this time. It's just, I don't understand the 1800s. But aside from being tarred and feathered, tragically, more than a few Mormons were murdered. And likely this left them feeling a very us-against-them mentality, and made them want to fiercely protect their own. They were eventually run out of Ohio and Missouri and landed in Nauvoo, Illinois. According to the book, The Mountain Meadows Massacre, written by Juanita Brooks, within, quote, 5 years, they transformed it into a busy town, the center of a rich farming district, a town where business prospered, a printing press was set up, a temple begun, and a municipal university projected. With a population of 15,000, it was the largest city in the state. Through bitter experience, Joseph Smith had learned to protect his people under the law, so he secured for his city a charter, which made it almost independent of the state, and which gave it an army for its protection. The very prosperity of Nauvoo carried with it the seeds of trouble. The Mormons were already too numerous, and daily their numbers were increasing. They still voted as a unit, playing the Whigs and Democrats against each other for favors and eventually arousing the ill will of both. Proud of their accomplishments and secure in the protection of their charter, they perhaps became overconfident. Joseph Smith even aspired to the presidency of the United States, and he sent his missionaries out to campaign for him, along with their preaching. This is now me just paraphrasing. And this all encouraged a more vehement opposition from without. And there was division within as well. Some leaders that weren't playing nice with others were excommunicated, and they defiantly set up a newspaper which attacked Joseph Smith so intensely, and he was also the mayor of the city, that he declared them a menace to society. Not to be confused with a film of the same name, though very, very similar plot lines. Greg just stopped me to say, Rachel, you don't know the plot line of Menace to Society, which is true, and that was kind of the point of the very dumb joke. Anywho, very much like the Hood in Menace to Society, the public reaction was instant and violent. See, I'm weaving it in. I do know that it's kind of about the Hood, all right? So then Mormon leaders were arrested and housed in a jail in Carthage, Illinois, under the promise of protection to await trial. But unwilling to delay for the action of a court, a mob gathered around the jail, just fury mounting, until they attacked the prison cell where Joseph Smith was held and killed him and his brother. In Smith's absence, the Mormons did not disband and give up. Oh no. Shortly after Smith was killed, a man named Brigham Young claimed he was the new president, and the Mormons agreed, as they claimed, he sounded so much like Joseph Smith when he spoke that it must be an act of God. You're right, it's always an act of God. Not like your plant died because you didn't water it, know what I mean? Young quickly took over where Smith left off, and even made plans to take the remaining LDS faithful to far away Utah, where they could live their own way, in peace, away from the watchful eye of the law and non-believers. You see, Utah was part of Mexico at the time and couldn't be touched by U.S. law. Brigham and his followers felt very territorial over this land as a result. They even formed their own Mormon militia groups, promising wrath to anyone that infringed on their beliefs and land. And wrath is the theme of this episode, as you will soon see. They constantly feared the invasion of U.S. troops on their land, and at Brigham Young's orders began stockpiling ammunition, powder, caps, grain, and told the believers to come home to Utah if one was living elsewhere. They needed to team up. According to Mormon author Juanita Brooks of Meadow Mountain Massacre, she says, quote, "Whether for defense of their rights or for ultimate independence, the fervor of war spread, until by mid-August a military organization had been set up in every town and village. Every able-bodied man in the territory was mustered into service. Military drills and inspection of arms were systematic and regular. As part of the general policy that Mormon economy should be independent of the outside and should consume only what it could produce, there had been early efforts by the saints to manufacture their own ammunition, powder, and lead," end quote. Later, John D. Lee, a recent convert, who the entire massacre would unfairly eventually be solely pinned on, joined one such group called the Danites, whose job was to shield and defend Mormons at all costs. Back when they were in Missouri, when some Missourians opposed the right of Mormons to vote, Lee and his fellow Danites grabbed clubs and rushed the crowd. Lee later said that, quote, "I felt the power of God nerve my arm for the fray," end quote. Buildings were burned, and Lee later admitted that he had participated in looting. Lee was essentially rewarded for such a sacrifice, though, by Brigham Young, Smith's successor, and he had even invited him to join on the trek to the dangerous and treacherous Utah Territory, and even named him the Captain of 50, a ranking based on number of people under one's command. Lee served as a clerk and purchasing agent as well. Now armed with the confidence of the church's new president, John D. Lee was ready and willing to do anything to defend the church he was so devoted to, and additionally rewarded for such stringent devotion. A recipe for cult follower disaster of the worst kind. The original Mormon settlers of 1847 soon turned into thousands living in the Great Salt Lake Valley. But just as they were starting to breathe a sigh of off-the-grid privacy relief, Mexico turned the land over to the U.S., and all the problems they were trying to escape from arose again. Mormons and the secular U.S. government's feud still exist today, but early on there was a bit of hope, as President Millard Fillmore appointed Brigham Young governor of the Utah Territory and superintendent of Indian Affairs. Mormons were still, though, entirely untrusting of the U.S. government, maybe in part because they were trying to hide their practice of polygamy that would, yes, be denounced by the Mormon president Wilford Woodruff in 1890, but was a part of many Mormons' lives early in the years of the church, and still is today, but only out in the open if you have a reality show. I'm joking. Being judged and punished for polygamy, not only by the government, but by outsiders, including the murder of polygamist Parley Pratt, who the Mormons saw as a martyr, only made them pull into isolation more. And like any good doomsday group, they needed to prepare for the apocalyptic end, or even an attack of that level from the quote-unquote Americans, any non-Mormon American citizen, or the U.S. government. One group that they initially seemed to get along with, though, were the Native Americans, as they could bond over their persecution that they both feel they had. Perhaps one more serious than the other is all I'm going to say. But Young slightly did succeed in getting the Paiute Indians from nearby Mountain Meadows on his side, some allegedly willing to join the fight against their persecutors. Because Young had been appointed as Utah Territory governor, he also succeeded in closing the area off. He warned outsiders that if they trespassed, the Mormon militia would take care of them, and he even was able to demand people traveling through the area obtain a permit, otherwise, martial law would be enforced. an eerie prelude to what happened to anywhere from 120 to 140 people, allegedly. As many people were emigrating to the West, namely California in this case, and took the route via wagon train through this hostile territory, most notably, in this case, the Baker-Thatcher group. I should state that according to a reprint of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, that number could be exaggerated, the number of deaths. Some reports state that it was 67, some 93, and some upwards of 140. Regardless, the massacre was horrific, and many people died. All began because perhaps the Baker-Thatcher party crossing the Utah territory lines had no idea a permit was required. I mean, what were they supposed to send it over the telegraph to any wagon train? How were they supposed to know? But more likely than that was the Mormons' distrust for outsiders. And with the group being riled up by their leaders and elders, they probably felt even more victimized and defensive. I mean, the Baker-Thatcher tribe was simply stopping over in Utah on their way to California, completely unaware that a group of religious zealots who felt like the victims of everyone's persecution was waiting in the wings to exact their quote-unquote revenge on the Americans. I hope by the end of this to come up with a solid reasoning for the why of this massacre, but it is so savage and seemingly unnecessary toward perfect strangers that it makes my mind spin. So who are the Baker-Thatcher Party? Well, in early 1857, the Baker-Thatcher Party was formed from several groups, mainly from Marion, Crawford, Carroll, and Johnson counties in northwestern Arkansas. They assembled into a wagon train at Beller's Stand south of Harrison to emigrate to Southern California. The group was named after Colonel Alexander Thatcher, who, having already made the journey to California twice before, had become its main leader. By contemporary standards, the Baker-Thatcher Party was prosperous, carefully organized, and well-equipped for the journey. The wagons were considered pretty luxurious for the times. They had thoroughbred horses, tons of herds of cattle, and they even had over $100,000 worth of gold coins hidden in the floorboards of the wagons. They were joined along the way by families and individuals from other states as well, including Missouri. And like I said, the group was relatively wealthy and had planned to restock its supplies in Salt Lake City, as did most wagon trains at the time. But unfortunately, the Baker-Thatcher Party was refused stocks in Salt Lake City. And so they had to choose to leave there and take the old Spanish Trail, which passed through southern Utah. In August 1857, the Mormon apostle George A. Smith traveled throughout the southern part of the territory, instructing the settlers to stockpile grain. While on his return trip to Salt Lake City, Smith camped near the Baker-Thatcher Party on August 25th at Corn Creek. They had traveled the 165 miles south from Salt Lake City, and Jacob Hamblin suggested that the wagon train continue on the trail and rest their cattle at Mountain Meadows, which had good pasture and was adjacent to his homestead. It was said that they did graze their cattle there, unaware of the permit required by Brigham Young to even pass through, let alone graze cattle. In this territory as well, the Mormons were prohibited from selling any goods to the wagon trains. They would literally be punished by the leaders. John D. Lee and Apostle George A. Smith then met with the Paiutes, a tribe of Native Americans in the region, and warned them that the encroaching Americans threatened both them and the Mormons. Then rumors circulated that members of the Baker-Thatcher train might poison water and cattle along their way. According to Mountain Meadows Massacre, quote, "This group began to have trouble soon after they left Salt Lake City, there can be no doubt. And much of this grew out of the belligerent attitude of the Mormons and their steady refusal to sell supplies. But some of it also must be attributed to the conduct of the travelers themselves. Reports of their boastful and hateful remarks came to us from many sources. Little things like naming their oxen Brigham Young or Heber C. Kimball, and then cursing them roundly as they passed through the Mormon villages, or trying to buy provisions, and upon being refused, popping the head off a chicken with a long bull or whip, or turning their cattle into the Mormon fields," end quote. So with that and other justifications, the Mormons really wanted to retaliate. And these are justifications after the fact, oftentimes. So whether the accounts of the Baker-Fancher party instigating were true, probably not. As many said, they were an extremely polite group who had no idea what they were wagon training into. Because the Mormons refused to trade with them or sell goods, the Baker-Fancher party began to have to slaughter their own cattle to eat. And they were refused goods no matter how much they would pay. And any Mormon, like I said, who sold to them was sorely punished. But rumors and reason for their growing hostility and vengeance were abound. Again, that rumor that the party poisoned their water source was a great source of justification after the horrible massacre became a stain on the church's history. But the Mormons still kept riling up an already furiously taken advantage of Native American tribe, who felt, and rightfully so, that the American government had done them wrong. Mormon leaders perhaps capitalized on their strife and encouraged them to retaliate and go for blood. The Mormons' war strategy became using the natives as weapons for the Lord. Later, it was revealed that a note sent from Brigham Young to Elder Jacob Hamlin, remember him? Just 1 month before the bloody massacre, on August 4th, 1857, stated in one part, quote, "Continue the conciliatory policy towards the Indians, which I have ever recommended, and seek by works of righteousness to obtain their love and confidence. For they must learn that they have either got to help us or the United States will kill us both," end quote. No doubt intended to rile both parties to violence. Many Mormons involved in the attack felt it their godly duty, and some were involved out of sheer fear for their own lives if they did not. Another letter recovered later said that one of the participants said he accepted this as an order that could not be disobeyed without imperiling his own life, end quote. So how did the massacre begin? On September 7th, 1857, the Baker-Fancher party was camped at Mountain Meadows when Paiutes and some Mormons dressed as Paiutes to conceal their Mormon affiliation attacked as they were making breakfast. The first bullet hit a child who fell over. Seven men then fell to the ground. Alexander Fancher had been struck in the neck, and Baker was seriously wounded. Completely ambushed and surrounded by Mountains, the party circled their wagons and attempted to fight back, but the siege continued for 5 days. They were so overcome by the Mormons, dressed as Paiutes, that they couldn't even bury their dead or go to the creek for water or tend to their wounded. They were completely surrounded. If they left their camp and even went to go get water, they were immediately met with gunfire. They couldn't do anything. They began to run out of ammunition, water, and provisions, and the Mormon attackers concluded that the emigrants maybe had figured out their ruse, because many of the Paiutes left this terrible attack and gave up as they probably realized it was absolutely unnecessary. And so they recruited more Mormons, dressed them up as Paiutes, but they thought that perhaps the emigrants maybe saw some white skin under the disguise and feared that word of their participation would encourage the U.S. Army to attack immediately. Allegedly, it was then that militia commander William H. Dame ordered his men to leave no witness. The emigrants were to be, quote, "decoyed out and destroyed with the exception of the small children," end quote, who were, quote, "too young to tell tales," according to another militia commander, Major John Higbee, who relayed these orders to John D. Lee. And this is by far the shittiest part of this. It's when they tricked them. On September 11th, John D. Lee and a group of militiamen approached the camp under a white flag and offered a truce, with assurances that Lee and his men would escort the emigrants to safety in Cedar City. All they would have to do is leave their livestock and possessions to the Paiutes, and having no good options, the emigrants, about 120 men, women, and children, laid down their weapons and followed Lee and the militia away from the camp in three groups, the last compromising adult males. It was over quickly. The Arkansas men were shot at point-blank range. The women and children ahead were slaughtered by bullets and arrows in an ambush party. No one over the age of 7 survived. The victims were hastily buried, and locals auctioned off or distributed their possessions and took in the surviving 17 young children. The young children were literally taken in by their parents' murderers. The army did arrive in Utah in 1858, but no war ensued. Young and the Buchanan administration negotiated an agreement in which Young would give way to a new governor. The following year, troops led by Major James H. Carleton went to Mountain Meadows to investigate the killings and found the bones of, quote, very small children. The soldiers gathered skulls and bones and erected a cairn with the words, quote, here are 120 men, women, and children who were massacred in cold blood early in September 1857. They were from Arkansas. They marked the site with a cross inscribed, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Investigations resulted in 9 indictments. Of the men who were indicted, only John D. Lee was tried in the court of law. After 2 trials in the Utah Territory, Lee was convicted by a jury, sentenced to death, and executed by a Utah firing squad on March 23, 1877. To this day, historians attribute the massacre to a combination of factors, including war hysteria about the possible invasion of Mormon territory and Mormon teachings against outsiders, which were part of the Mormon Reformation period. Scholars debate whether senior Mormon leadership, including Brigham Young, directly instigated the massacre or if responsibility for it lay only with the local leaders in southern Utah. I personally think Brigham Young instigated it per that letter that he sent out to his leaders, but that's just my opinion. So we'll end this episode with the names of those that were massacred at Mountain Meadows in September 1857. Captain John T. Baker from Carroll County, Arkansas. George W. Baker, who had a wife and 1 child. Very sad that they don't have their names. It was the 1800s. Abel Baker, Milliam Rush, Alan Descarzo, David W. Beller, Melissa Ann Beller, Robert Fancher, Charles R. Mitchell with wife and 1 child, Marion, Joel D. Mitchell, Lawson Mitchell, William and John Pruitt, 2 brothers, Jesse Dunlap, wife and 6 children, L.D. Dunlap with a wife and 5 children, William Wood, Solomon Wood, Richard Wilson, Milam Jones with a wife and 1 child, Johnson, Pleasant Tackett with a wife and 2 child, Cynthia Tackett and 3 children, Josiah Miller with a wife and 3 children, William Cameron with a wife and 5 children, Alexander Fancher with a wife and 4 children, Benton, Peter Huff with a wife and 3 children. Thank you guys so much for listening. I will see you next week. Love you. Bye.